Hey everyone, so welcome to the second episode of The World in the Satin Bag. Just a quick update on the project. I actually received a huge donation with the first episode, which was $150. That's over halfway to the first marker, the first major hurdle. So hopefully we'll hit that 250 marker and I can actually write another story, which would be a lot of fun. So again, you know, I'll put up the show notes and everything, and I hope you guys are enjoying the first chapter, and we'll enjoy the second chapter as well. So I will shut up now and get right to it. Chapter 2, Lights. James woke, groggy, head throbbing with a familiar rhythm, thump thump, thump thump. His eyes were still closed when he groaned, the pain in the back of his head daring him to touch it, but he didn't dare. He knew he had a bruise, sensitive, bulging, and ugly. In the recesses of his ears, a whistling sound, like a train in a deep cavern, played brightly. Radio reception, he thought. Someone had told him once that the high-pitched sounds in his ears were unfiltered radio frequencies. He never believed it, thinking it pure nonsense, but for some reason it had stuck. Grimacing, James worked up the nerve to open his eyes. He cracked his eyelids, expecting there to be a bright light shining through the window and the sound of warbling birds in the trees. But the room was utterly dark, like the underbrush of a dense forest in a moonless night. Thick mats of clouds hid the moon's rays and rid the landscape of any shadows, except those of the darkest forms, the kind James wouldn't walk into on his own. But most of all, the room was empty. Laura's lamp no longer shined, its dim form lost under the bed. Laura was nowhere to be found. At a snail's pace, James rolled to his knees and touched the back of his head with delicate fingers. He winced when his fingers discovered the bulge, but he was thankful that they came away dry. Standing, he took a few groggy steps forward, knelt again, and searched for the lamp underneath the bed, fumbling about blindly with his hand. His hand soon discovered the handle, and he pulled the plastic cylinder up to his face, fumbling with the dial and slapping the contraption until the little light blinked alive and illuminated the room. "Laura?" His voice quivered. The world seemed to close in around him, the walls shrinking as the memories came flooding back. The charred circle in the center of the room made the memories more vivid. He stepped towards it, crouched, and touched the burnt wood, crushing a piece into black powder. The scent of fire became anew, alighting his senses with smoky flavors. "Laura?" His voice came with more confidence now, echoing in the bedroom. But there was no answer except the call of wind rushing against the side of the manor and the faint roar of thunder in the distance. James held back the urge to panic. He hadn't expected her to respond. Somehow he knew she was gone, and now, more than ever, he had to resist temptation to let his fears consume him. He had to be brave just this once. Laura wasn't there to lift him from his fears or defend him from the dark. She was gone, lost to the fire creatures. He wanted to scream her name and cry and curl up in the corner begging someone to rescue him. But he resisted the urge and the trembling in his knees and the dreadful cold coursing around his neck. Every instinct and fear, he resisted. The satin bag rested in the center of the charred circle. He hadn't noticed it before, and the sight of it forced him back for a moment, as if being near it would bring the serpents back. Then, silent, he grabbed the strings and tied them closed with fierce movements, tying one knot after another until even he wasn't sure he could open it easily. For a moment, he stared at the bag, gently brushing his fingers along the smooth fabric. Along its edges, he saw the outline of the shield knot. "What am I going to do with this thing? What about Laura?" The thought brought a bad taste to his mouth. She had disappeared right before his eyes, and somewhere, someplace, she still lived. He hoped she still lived. The flames hadn't killed her, he was sure of that. But nobody would believe him if he said giant flame serpents had stolen her in the night. Who would come to Laura's rescue then? The bag twitched under his hand, once, twice, and then over and over, as if something inside was trying to get out. The bag slithered across the floor, pushing against his knee. He gasped and swatted it away. From the far corner, the bag burst into continuous, sporadic motion, like a ragged heart. It sagged over, creating a bulbous mass of fabric, squiggling as if it was filled with little worms. A thunderclap shook the room. He covered his ears, searching for the source. Items all over the room flew into motion, as if spurned into action by the satin bag. He saw the Celtic symbols woven or carved or drawn into their surfaces. The dresser, bed, and chairs remained motionless, unmarked. Another burst of sound filled the room. This time it was an inhuman cry emanating from the bag. Shivering, he watched the object as it wriggled on the floor. More cries shook the room, the voices of an eagle, bear, and snake forced together into an eerie tremor. He clasped his hands tight over his ears. The shield knot on the satin bag burned to life, the pattern lighting up with orange embers which fast became intricate rivers of fire. The other moving objects in the room soon followed. James backed away, wary and afraid. Again his panic reflex called, and he eyed the window, but it was too far away. The door was closer. His terrified face reflected back at him in the broken glass, and he realized that the cloth wrapped over his wound glowed with fire, too. He ran to the window, clutching his ears with one hand and pulling at the cloth with the other. The fire emitted no heat, he noticed, but the knot refused to come undone. Laura had tied it too tight. A clang drew his attention back to the center of the room. Statues and music boxes lifted from their resting places and flew to circle the satin bag, which had since lifted from the ground as if by invisible hands. The knot he had tied burst open. Red fire poured from the opening, filling the far corner of the room and rotating to create a vortex of light and flame. James backed into the wall again and again, unable to turn away to look for the door. The vortex shifted, blocking the window from view and raking the ceiling and bed and walls. The whirling items engulfed in its fire. But no heat filled the room, only the cold and the wind flicking his skin. Taking a deep breath, he sought the door, inching along the wall in its direction. A few more strides to his right, and he would be able to escape. Just a few steps. The doorknob found its way into his hand. He twisted. The familiar click of the handle reverberated through his fingers. But before he could open the door and squeeze through, something slammed him against the wall. He struggled against the force, clutching the knob with all his might. With a final burst of energy, he shoved himself forward, pulling the door with him, and jammed his foot into the opening. The force struck the door over and over, crashing the corner of the wood into his foot, but he ignored the pain and wriggled through. The voice screeched in protest, hissing words he didn't understand. He heard the door bang violently shut behind him, but didn't look back. His courage had left him. At a full run, James flew down the hall, his legs racing and the scratch on his knee paining him. But he ran down the long hall, the huge zigzag of stairs that led to the front door, three at a time, and finally to the door itself. With each step, the cloth around his arm grew dimmer until, at last, it blinked out. He tripped more than once, but he scrambled to his feet and kept going until he slammed into the front door. It wouldn't budge, barred shut by wood planks on the outside. James found himself in complete darkness again, with no way out. Frantic, he searched for a window. The windows were boarded too, like everything in the building. Yet the boards were thin behind the glass, and he could break through them if he had something to strike with. He fumbled around the room, keeping his bearings fresh in his mind so he didn't get lost, and eventually bumped his knee into something metal. He wrapped his hands around the thin end and jogged back to the window. From above, the door to the other rooms opened and crashed shut, over and over in perfect sync. James felt the vibrations shivering up his legs, encouraging him in his task. He lifted the metal object and shattered the window. Glass fell all around him. He swung again and again. Bit by bit, the boards on the outside crumbled and splintered, too old to withstand such a beating. A few more hits later, and he had made a hole big enough for him to squeeze through. Getting through proved more difficult than he had hoped. His clothes snagged on the jagged wood, sometimes pulling the wood free, other times held tight. The sounds from above had gone from his mind. He was focused, determined. Then he was through, leaving behind shreds of clothing and landing with a crunchy thud in the snow outside. Without hesitation, he jumped to his feet and ran with all his might, forgetting everything for that brief moment as he trudged through a foot of snow like it was nothing more than air. Some time later, he stopped. The Hanser grounds were far behind him now, but he swore he could still hear the screams. He breathed ragged, wheezing breaths. His head throbbed again. It had all been too much. The world seemed to bubble and warp around him. He leaned over to catch his breath, and it was all he could do to stay standing. A few seconds of conscious thought later, and he passed out. James woke, a million times groggier than before. At first, he couldn't open his eyes. They were heavy and his muscles protested. When he managed to get them open, he recognized the ocean wave patterns at the end of his bed, blurry for a moment and then clear as day. The familiar tan dresser and light blue walls were there too, and his model airplane swung gently as if in greeting. "Thank goodness you're awake!" James saw his mother at the door. She stood straight, her face drooping from fear and concern. Her brown hair was unkempt, and her eyes, great pools of green, were intense. Around her shoulders hung a pink bathrobe. "Philip, come here!" she screamed down the hall. A man slid in beside her, his father. Brown eyes, bushy eyebrows, and a face that always looked ready to smile. He wore a dark blue suit with a red tie, the one James had given him for a birthday, in which he was in the process of tying. James was glad to see both of them again, even if he knew his father would be at work soon enough. "How are you feeling?" James curled his lip into a half-smile, glad to hear his father's soprano voice again. "Alive." "Yes, thankfully," his mother fidgeted with her robe. "The doctor said you took quite a hit to the head. What happened?" James paused. He wasn't quite sure how to tell them what had really happened. They surely wouldn't believe him. He bit his tongue. "Well, I can tell you this," Mother said, raising her voice ever so slightly. "No more adventures to the Hands or Grounds. Especially not on your own." His father's voice was unusually stern. "I wasn't alone," James blurted the words out. He would have to tell them something. The two of them looked at him questioningly. "Laura was with me." "Laura, I see. Well, I suppose we'll have to have a talk with Laura's parents, then. Neither of you were supposed to be out there at that time of night. What were you thinking?" She clenched her fist and turned to leave. "No, wait!" Then he blurted the whole story out. He cared more about Laura's welfare, he realized, than his childish pride. He told them about the satin bag, the symbols, the lights, and flames, and about how Laura had disappeared. Every detail he could remember he said without pause, sucking in great breaths of air when he needed it. Both of his parents eyed one another, cocking their heads slightly. In a strange way, their faces were stricken with a surprise James had not expected. It was more than surprise, more than the look of disbelief he assumed they would have given him. For a brief moment, they looked at him as if they believed him. Then the moment was gone, and they returned bewildered faces to him. "Such stories. I think we've raised a writer," his father said. "Well, under other circumstances, I would praise your imagination, but right now is not the time. You were to stay away from the Hands or Grounds, and especially from that dreaded manor. Understood?" "I'm not lying, Mom." "Understood?" Her eyes narrowed. He nodded. "Good. And your father and I will have a chat with Laura's parents right now." She walked out and down the hall, thumping her feet. His father closed the door and leaned against it. "Look, we're glad you're all right, but that whole place is dangerous. That's why it's condemned. It's high time the city puts a fence around it to keep you lot from getting into mischief. A board probably fell and hit you on the head, and you dreamt of that story." "I didn't dream it." "Sometimes dreams seem real," his father shrugged. James frowned. "You're lucky that the doctor said you should stay in bed for a while. We were going to ground you." His father smiled. "Get some sleep. Laura's probably at home in bed, too. Just get some sleep, and we'll see you when we get home." James nodded and watched his father leave. He heard a car engine stutter to life outside. The tires crackled on the gravel driveway, and then silence reigned in his room. Lifting his head left him dizzy, he soon discovered, but eventually the world stopped spinning and the mild throbs subsided. He sat there thinking about his parents and the strange look that had been on their faces. "They know something," he thought. With a grunt, he managed to tilt over and reach under the bed. He produced a thin laptop computer and sat back against his pillow, resting the laptop on his lap. His parents had always been supportive of his interest in technology, especially his father, who had secured himself a reputation as a web designer in Woodton, and had even made websites for a number of the downtown businesses. His mother worked as his secretary, more or less, but she had a hand in how the financial side of things went. James had always been grateful that his parents supported him in his thirst for knowledge. He figured they had hopes to raise a technological genius of some sort, but he was bound to disappoint them when he turned to history or some other field. While the computer booted up, he thought about what he was going to search for. He spent enough time on the internet to know where to find the usual information, but the events of the previous night were far beyond normal. When the desktop appeared, he followed his first instinct and went to the website for the Woodton Chronicle. He knew the Chronicle kept an extensive online archive and figured it was a good place to start. Clicking through to the archive search page, he ran the list of possible searches through his mind. He decided to start big by typing Hands or Manor and hitting enter. He skimmed the articles that appeared. Each had something to do with the sale of Hands or Manor. The original owners had died in the house, which got passed down to their next of kin. They eventually sold it, and the new owner spent a year there before clearing out without a word and selling it too. From then on, Hands or Manor passed between hands, but not a single person ever actually lived in it for more than a few months, except the original owners, who people said had never left. Ghosts. Once upon a time, James would have dismissed the talk of such things as delusional. Now he thought differently. That explains why the place is still furnished. Nobody ever cleared it out. But the articles didn't tell him anything that might explain the events of the previous night. Ghosts couldn't make a person disappear, at least not in any story he had ever read. They were limited by having no corporeal form. It had to be something else. With a few theories brewing, he started a new search. He tried a couple keywords related to the supernatural, ghosts, voices, and the like, but came up even more lost than before. Nothing he found led him in the right direction. The moment someone suggested something strange or unusual, the trail ended. James couldn't blame the reporters or anyone else in Woodton. Few people believed in the supernatural, and there were more interesting things to report on in the town. Farming disputes, corrupt politicians, and even the occasional food poisoning in a local restaurant. Silly tales of ghosts weren't high on everyone's list. James clicked back again and sighed. He thought hard and harder still, imagining the giant brick wall that blocked him. Old, moldy, and monstrous, separating him from the little light bulb on the other side where one brilliant thought rested. And then it came to him, light pushing the bricks aside and flowing over him, filling him with anticipation. He started from the beginning once more and typed missing persons. He laughed at himself for not thinking of it sooner. When several dozen articles appeared, he laughed a little harder, but regretted it when his head began to throb. He should have known that in the long history of Woodton there would have been many reports of missing people. Some would have been solved and others not. Woodton was by no means a small town, but neither was it a city. A population of 12,000 might seem small to the great metropolises on the coasts, but for a place known as that town between the hills, it was a large sum. Woodton sat nestled in the bottom of a wide, shallow valley. Over the hills, climbing in altitude gradually, were other towns. It had its fair share of churches, five schools, and a small but elegant town hall that tripled as the local action and dance halls. And in a town that size, the Chronicle was bound to have reported on a considerable number of missing persons. Still more, James knew, probably never saw print in any form. He narrowed the search to children and grinned when only five came up. He read them. Two boys, two girls, and an outsider who had appeared in Woodton just as quickly disappeared as if he had never existed. Neither had been solved, nor did the article give any other useful information, except dates. 1856, 1886, 1916, 1946, and 1976, each in January. James soaked them in, exactly 30 years apart. He pondered the significance. 30 years was a long time, but for each disappearance to be exactly that many years apart seemed more than coincidence, and when he drew the connection out farther, the oddness of the disappearances grew. 30 years from the last date made it present time, January 2006. That meant that Laura was the sixth disappearance to follow the pattern. James knew there was a connection there. Surely something he had read would have given it away. But if there was a connection, it had not been made blatantly obvious. He would have to dig deeper. There has to be a connection, he thought. It's more than mere coincidence. It has to be. Searching his memory, he tried to remember when the Hanser Manor had been sold, but, strangely enough, the information wasn't there. He had never looked for the dates. His next thought had barely registered when his fingers began the new search. There it was, sitting in front of him as if it had been waiting for him. Hanser Manor had been sold 3 months after each of the disappearances. He giggled, joyous and excited, but contained. The information was circumstantial, but James couldn't help but grin. Each of those children had been in Hanser and had probably seen the same things he had seen. The satin bag had gobbled them all up in flames, just like Laura. His stomach dropped. All those children had been snatched up, and their parents left with nothing to do but hope they would return. Likely some of the parents still lived in Woodton, hoping endlessly. Most of them had died without ever seeing their children again. Maybe that's how my parents felt when they found me out in the snow. The gravel driveway crackled again. His parents were home. When the engine cut off and the doors thumped shut, he could hear their muffled argument. He hadn't moved much since they had left and thought to lean over and open the window enough to hear. He dreaded the throbbing to come. But I have to know what they're saying. That thought was all it took for James to gather the strength necessary to stand up, stumble through the window, and carefully slide it open. The cold winter air chilled him to the bone. "She's the sixth, Philip," his mother choked on the words. "The sixth, for heaven's sake! Something has to be done about that god-awful place. There's nothing we can do. We don't own it. The council has to make that decision." "They'll never make the decision you know is necessary. Mayor or no mayor, this town will never do anything. What do you suggest?" His father was calm, measured, his words terse. There was a long pause. James heard feet rustling and the wind whistling like a bloated owl. "Burn it. It's made of stone. That place won't just burn down. Burn everything inside and then collapse the building. We don't have the means to do that. We could have lost James to that infernal place. Did you stop and consider that?" "Yes, it's been on my mind since he was born. The only way to keep him away from that place is to tell him everything about Angtheland. And I mean everything. But the council forbids it, and you know what will happen if we try to leave. We know too much. We're a part of this whether we like it or not." His father paused and the feet rustling resumed. "You know the punishment for betrayal." "Yes. We kept him in the dark as long as we could. It's too late now. Philip. He cut her off. The worst is over. We'll make it clear to him that he cannot go near that place, okay? I think he's seen the eye. His father said nothing. The wind ceased its whistling, as if in on that silent moment. Then James heard a bang. His father had struck the side of the house with his hand. Don't talk like that. The argument ended, and the front door opened and slammed shut. James heard a set of long sighs, his mother dispelling her fears into the winter. He closed the window, careful again to be quiet about it, and got back into bed. He put his laptop in sleep mode and curled into a ball, pretending to sleep. He didn't want to face them. Too many questions were lingering in his mind. They knew a lot more than he had ever thought, and the whole town seemed to be in on whatever had happened at Hanser Manor last night and many years before. Now he had new things to consider. What sort of name was Anktheland? And why had his mother's voice grown so terrified when she had mentioned the eye? He remembered it vividly, and the fire it had spewed forth the night before. What was the council, and who manned it? But no question was more important to him than this. Where did the eye take Laura? When his parents came into the room to check on him, he might as well have been asleep with how deep in thought he had become. And when they drew his curtains and left him to his dreams, the question spun even faster in his mind. He had to know the answers, and he would do whatever it took to find them. And there you have it. That is the second chapter of The World in the Satin Bag. I hope you enjoyed it. Again, if you liked it, please donate. Just go to my blog, wisb.blogspot.com. It's on the side, the little chip-in thing. Or you can send it straight to my PayPal email, which is arconna@yahoo.com. Feel free to send anything, a dollar, whatever you like. So, and of course, I'd love to hear comments. So if you enjoyed it, let me know. And I will see you next time with the next episode, Chapter 3.